I'm okay with that. It just means coffee, keep the coffee coming, and all that stuff. All right, Calvinism. Before I get to Bullinger and Beza, and then those two extremes that we're going to talk about, Calvin's influence on the church in the West. And a lot of this stuff I'm going to revisit, I just think it's important to just see it at the DNA level coming out of Geneva. I think that's important. Here's why it's important. Why? So you can give excessive credit to one man? The worship of man? No. Here's why. There's a lot of reasons, but here's one reason. Why look at the DNA of somebody's mind under the microscope? Here's one reason, because I want to think accurately, and though I may come to disagree with Calvin, as you already saw, I disagree with his view of church polity and his reading of Scripture, and I think I can deconstruct his view and show you from history how he's, where he's coming from and why he went what I think was the wrong way. Nevertheless, I'm going to show you something here coming out of Geneva that I want to get at least that right. Okay? So, there's no virtue in stepping in somebody else's holes. We're going to have our own holes we're going to step in. We're going to have our own blind spots. There's no virtue at all in not looking back at the rearview mirror and learning from history, not only from their mistakes, but what they did right. And if I can tell that Calvin did a bunch of things right and thought rightly about so many crucial things and it changed the world, I want to at least get those things right. Okay, the way I just said that, how can you argue against that? Unless you're crazy and you like darkness and stepping in holes. In which case, you shouldn't be leading people. All right. Calvin's influence on the church in the West. So, you know, look at the way in which Calvin's theology, particularly his systematic expression of it in the Institutes, look at the way that that has shaped the Western world subsequent to his day. Now, the most obvious influence was straight theology. The first edition of the Institutes was complete in 1536 when he was just 26 years old. Now, by the time it's finished and disseminates throughout the Western world, that masterpiece really is equaled in nonfiction only by Plato's Republic, Aristotle's main books, Metaphysics, Ethics, Politics, Augustine's City of God, and the Summa Theologica of Aquinas. Really, the only nonfiction works prior to that that can rival that in effect and influence. Modern works, such as Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, and Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, have had similar effects in a different direction. As for fiction, it may be argued that only the works of Shakespeare or The Pilgrim's Progress of Bunyan have been read by more people. But let's take the following standard. What book written by a mere mortal has so directly shaped the overall worldview of more people, and in so doing fostered a more just and humane social condition? If that's the standard, then Calvin's Institutes is in a class by itself. And a work of literature doesn't achieve that unless it deals comprehensively with the biggest questions that human beings have. I already mentioned the Christology of Calvin. It's often overlooked on a popular level. But within the Reformed tradition and among historic theologians, it's well known that his work on the three offices of the Son in his mediator role was formative for a lot of things. For example, one example, Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex, The Law is King, where you started to have this tradition, and you can argue that it went all the way back to de Bracton in English law, but the idea that the three functions of government, law giving, law interpreting, law enforcing, what we recognize as the legislative, judicial, and executive branch, are the way they are, designed by God from the beginning, even if governments have deviated from it, designed to reflect the offices of Christ. Okay? And so that's something that you can draw out in Western history. Also, before I get to Calvin's soteriology, Calvin was also sometimes referred to as a theologian of the Spirit. Calvin referred to the Holy Spirit as someone who is the applier of the bonds of love, that expression that shows up in the Old Testament. And Calvin said that without the Spirit, without the application of the Son's work, not that it would be worthless, but our obtaining of it would be impossible without the Holy Spirit applying the Son's work. And so he made much of the Holy Spirit's ministry. The soteriology of Calvin is grossly misunderstood by self-professing Calvinists on the one hand, who like to take the infamous 5 points out of their systematic and historical context, and by critics of Reformed theology, on the other hand, who deny that Calvin was a Calvinist because he did not write explicitly in the vein of the 5 points. And most particularly, some people will write, Calvin did not believe in the L. Paul Helm writes a very good essay explaining how Calvin did believe in limited atonement. He didn't necessarily call it that. Again, Synod of Dort, the Remonstrants show up 2 generations later, or at least a generation later. Now, both of those extremes are severely distorted. Calvin was very much the father of the Puritan attempt to complete the English Reformation. And this is seen most clearly in their defining document, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which was written in 1646. We'll return to it later on. The English and Scottish Puritans desired to write up a confession in the UK, and the Lord providentially provided that opportunity in the midst of civil war. Now, I personally believe it to be the most concise and helpful confession that the Church has ever produced. It's thoroughly Calvinistic, displaying the sovereignty of God, the glory of God, and the joy of the saints in Him. And it's been said that the English Puritans learned their theology from the Scriptures rather than from following the Institutes. And that may be true, but they were certainly not ignorant of or conflicting with Calvin's flow of thought. They were split on the question of supralapsarianism or infralapsarianism, and I'll come back to that when I get to Bullinger. But really, Calvin didn't explicitly lay that down in a way that demanded conformity. He did have an opinion about it, which I'll come back to. But Calvin's influence on the Puritans can be seen among both the English and the colonial Puritans, whose work ended for the most part after the First Great Awakening in the 1730s and 40s. But it's been argued that the American Revolution is, in many respects, owing to the theology and the lifestyle which the Puritan worldview left to all of the colonists, particularly among the New Englanders who started so much of the trouble before the Revolution. So of the nations affected by the Reformation, it can be argued that the churches in Scotland and Holland were able to carry out Calvin's ecclesiology in the fullest and most enduring sense. In fact, if you ever get criticized, as we've been, by fellow Reformed older brothers who will say, no, you need to be fully Reformed. What they mean is more Dutch. We don't know enough Scots men around here. But in Holland and Scotland, they really took to Calvin's ecclesiology down to the detail, the last detail. And yet, Calvin's influence on the secular destiny of the modern West has to be considered more extensive in some ways. The libraries of all learned men of the North American colonies, well into the 19th century in the United States, were dominated by Calvinistic authors no matter what the subject was. Even secular historians recognize Calvin's far-reaching influence on the social sciences and the social conscience of English culture as well as on the Dutch. Much of our system of government today, uncorrupted of course, which when did that happen? I don't know. But the design, on paper, can be traced back to Calvin's analysis of church, state, commerce, law, labor, and so on. Where good theology reigns supreme, there is more often than not an effect on everything else in society for the good. Education in general and literacy in particular were given a priority unknown before the reforms of Geneva. The three doctrines of God, man, and Scripture all have an instant effect on the enterprise of learning as a whole. And why is that? Well, the reason is that as God is restored to the center, as the all-explaining object of everything else, as the value of man is seen as extrinsic rather than intrinsic, in other words, man is so valuable because the infinite value of that which he reflects, and as the Word of God is placed directly back into the hands of the people, then the people themselves can know what this wisdom is that Calvin speaks so well of. And that literally changes everything. As to the civil sphere in particular, the very last chapter of the Institutes was devoted to the powers of the state. God created civil government, according to Calvin, for the same reason that he made everything else, namely to speak about his own triune glory. And this is why it has what Calvin sees as three parts of the state, according to Calvin: officers, laws, and the people. But the state did not just glorify God, it cared for man, checking the ravages of the fall. Didn't reverse the fall, didn't heal the fall, but it checks the excesses and evils of the fall. The powers of the state may punish, must punish, But this is not the exact same thing as divine wrath being manifested through natural disasters. For example, as he drew out a little bit, an earthquake and a tyrant are both instruments of justice, but a tyrant is acting unjustly as he misrepresents God's image. So Calvin says, For though tyrannies and unjust exercise of power, as they are full of disorder, are not an ordained government, yet the right of government is ordained by God for the well-being of mankind. So, the upshot, according to Calvin, is that because civil government, and therefore its offices, because civil government is designed by God for a specific purpose, that government which sufficiently deviates from this design is an illegitimate regime. Now, what practical effect did this have right away? Well, when John Knox first interacted with the Swiss leadership, he was seeking advice for how the Scottish Christians should relate to abuses of power back home. Knox at first, believe it or not, this fire-breathing Knox that would preach before Mary, he actually was more of a pietist at first. He thought the church will do what it does and let the state do what it does. And so he wrote for advice to Calvin and Bullinger, and they were both instrumental in changing Knox's view from that more hands-off approach to what became his fiery sermons and tracts against Mary and her regime. The form of government most conducive to maintain liberty, Calvin says, is a system compounded of aristocracy and democracy, so that maximum political freedom would be balanced out by the maximum intellectual objectivity. There's no question that Calvin's thought here is at one with the great Western tradition of liberty, particularly St. Thomas's concept of divine law informing civil law. So, Calvin basically said that the object of law is what he calls equity. He says, hence, this equity alone must be the goal and rule and limit of all laws. Whatever law shall be framed to that rule, directed to that goal, bound by that limit, there is no reason why we should disapprove of them, howsoever they may differ from the Jewish law or among themselves. So, because the law was the object of the state, whether we're talking about the officer or the people at large, because of that, there was recourse for any form of injustice. Though even this is to be balanced out with other truths and exercised in moderations. And so Calvin comes up with what I think is the defining sub-doctrine of that last chapter of the Institutes. Calvin asserted what he called the lesser magistrate, stepping in to do his lawful job. Not a mob, but a lesser magistrate stepping in the way between a tyrant and the people. And so he says that this lesser magistrate is appointed to restrain the willfulness of kings and not betray the freedom of the people. So it is this biblical notion that informed the American colonists in their conflict with Great Britain. A later Dutch theologian, Abraham Kuyper, would summarize what he called this political theology of Calvinism in this way. 3 points to the political theology of Calvinism, according to Kuyper. Number one, God only, and never any creature, is possessed of sovereign rights. Secondly, sin has, in the realm of politics, broken down the direct government of God. And thirdly, in whatever form this authority may reveal itself, man never possesses power over his fellow man in any other way than by the authority which descends upon him from the majesty of God. So you can see how Calvin's doctrine of God and man and Christ and salvation flows into this doctrine of politics. But clearly, Calvin's greatest influence was on those bookends of Reformed theology, divine sovereignty and divine glory, what we would call the real first and seventh point of a seven-point Calvinism. Those 5 points in the middle don't become less legitimate, they become more legitimate. They derive their meaning from God being sovereign over all things and doing everything for His glory. That efficient cause and end cause of all things makes sense of the 5 points, if it doesn't already. All right, that's Calvin. Let's move on here so we can cover it. The successors of Zwingli up north in Zurich and Calvin in Geneva were Bullinger and Beza. So first Bullinger, Heinrich Bullinger, and sometimes he was referred to as Henry as well, but Heinrich Bullinger. His dates are 1504 to 1575. He would make preservation and consolidation of the Swiss Reformation into a Pauline-like vision for a continental Reformation. His father, Dean Bullinger, like so many priests at the time, including perhaps Zwingli, by the way, took what amounts to a concubine, having children by them. So before that, priests were used to having children out of wedlock, taking women that were not their wives, and people would just wink, wink at it. Apparently, Zwingli kind of did sort of the same thing. And Bullinger's father did as well. That went on in Zurich big time, and it was totally, the Zurich leadership turned a blind eye to it. So that was still happening while Reformation was starting. And they were fixing it, but it was still happening. I don't remember if Heinrich himself was born out of wedlock. They might have become married after that. He was not the first child. But anyway, his father, Dean, would become thoroughly reformed in his own ministry, and we would assume in his family as well. I'll just assume that for the sake of charity. I haven't read that much on it to know. But he would preach the same gospel as Zwingli throughout the 1520s, and so that immediately captivated Bullinger's attention. The young Bullinger attended the university at Cologne, where he studied patristic and scholastic theology, and where he also encountered the writings of Luther and Melanchthon. Now, when he came home, he would teach at a convent school in Kappel from 1523 to 1529 and thoroughly reform its life and curriculum. So again, notice the emphasis on teaching for the first reformers. In fact, Luther made the comment, and I'll have to paraphrase here, but they all felt this way, that parents in their realm that did not subject their kids to this theological education were irresponsible parents. Okay? So, you know, obviously there was a, you know, these authors will say, and they championed the beginning of compulsory public school. Well, that's true, but these were Christians running it, and it's a whole different monster there, so I leave that as a footnote. But Bullinger befriends the Zurich reformer Zwingli at this point, and he would accompany him at a couple of different conferences with Anabaptists and with others in the 1520s. After Zwingli's death, Bullinger was unanimously elected to succeed him as the pastor at Grossmünster on December 9th, 1531. And at his first sermon, 2 days before Christmas, the congregation had sworn that the spirit of Zwingli had risen. But there was a difference between these two men. And it wouldn't be a difference in doctrine, really, or a basic spirit, but rather that Bullinger would add to Zwingli moderation and an expansive Catholic vision. Bullinger, more than anyone else except for maybe Bucer, but Bullinger had more credibility because he was a better theologian and had more respect throughout Europe. Bullinger really saw, kind of like Paul, all of Europe as fair game for the Reformation. He really believed that let's get unity. We won't compromise on anything that matters, but let's get unity here and have a creed and spread this throughout Europe. It's already spread so fast, so quickly. That time has come. And so he was not a nationalist, a patriot in that sense, as Zwingli was. Beza would call him, quote, the common shepherd of all Christian churches. So Bullinger richly earned the title bishop, because unlike titled bishops, he actually acted like a real one. For instance, he welcomed the exiled Lutheran preachers in 1548, even though they had previously denounced the Reformed doctrines in their ministries. Now, he didn't welcome them into the pulpit. He welcomed them into what essentially was an asylum refugee city. Throughout the decade of the 1530s, he would preach nearly every day. Then after 1542, only on Fridays and Sundays. By the way, if anybody ever said, well, you're only talking about revival, Matt. What does revival look like? Well, whether you're praying or preaching or in the living room studying the Word, you're pretty much doing it every day. And you say, wow, we all have kids and stuff like that. Well, do that at home with your kids, but you should at least kind of be coming together two or three times. Put it this way. If you're ever saying, do we have to come together? You're not. It's a good sign you might not be in revival. I should make a list one day, kind of a Jeff Foxworthy type. You might be in revival if you're this and not that, because it seems obvious if you're, you know, that's why we study church history. These guys were preaching every day. There was a demand for it. They weren't just a bunch of lunatics that were just out there in the street corner. It's not that that would be a bad thing if nothing's happening, but there was a hunger for it. So anyway, after 1542, he would reduce that only preaching on Fridays and Sundays. In the Zurich Seminary, It was stocked with the best of all the new Reformed theologians of the day. And a book of church order was prepared and accepted by the Synod on October 22, 1532. So he was moving fast to consolidate the life of Zurich that Zwingli had just whipped up with his preaching. And Zurich, as I said, would be a Protestant asylum, much like Geneva, fostering an Italian Reformed church there because of the amount of their refugees getting kicked out there. He would interact with the French monarchs, as Calvin had, pleading the case of the Huguenots and dedicating his works on Christian perfection in 1551 to Henry II and instruction in the Christian religion in 1559 to Francis II. His letters were prolific. He was exchanging thoughts with everybody from Bucer to Calvin to Melanchthon to Cranmer to Fox to Beza to John Knox to Peter Martyr. And it would seem that his letters sent to the Protestants in exile under Mary's reign actually were read and had sufficiently affected Elizabeth I so that she would not take the title of head of the English church, or at least he was so credited for that by Bishop Jewell at the time. So it may be that Bullinger, aside from all of her English advisors, was one of the people that convinced her, don't call yourself the head of the Anglican Church. Christ is the head of the church. And besides, you're a female, so be on the throne. More power to you. But don't call yourself the head of the church. And she was absolutely convinced of that. Now, what unique points of Bullinger's theology are noteworthy? We'll just mention two main things, predestination and the Lord's Supper. First of all, he would become the first noteworthy, respectable infralapsarian among the Reformed. Let me write these two words on the board. Supralapsarianism above is the first grammar words we're going to give to our kids in this academy. These two words right here. And infralapsarianism, you might remember from Church History 1, the lapsi, that the Donatists were getting on their case. Remember the lapses where those fell away? So lapse is a fall. And so, obviously, let me get another color here to circle these. The question here was about the seat or the cause or the end. And here's the point. As I stack up these words, it's going to start, hopefully, to dawn on you that this is a false dilemma. They're both true about different things. The question is predestination. What is predestination with reference to? What is God's choice of election with reference to? Okay? So he would be infralapsarian as opposed to Calvin and Beza, who were clearly supralapsarian. So the difference was made by those who didn't understand the doctrine as well as these original Swiss reformers. The real difference regards the relationship between election and the fall. So that the question that was asked was this: did God choose without respect to the fall or with respect to the fall? So, above, I'm going to put God. I'm going to put a big circle around everything. An arrow down here that says choice flowing downward from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. The choice is then going to have an arrow, and this circle is going to represent the same lump of clay falling, in that phrase from Romans 9. And the question is, does that choice have reference to something prior to the fall, or does it have reference to the fall? And I purposely state it generically. Does it have reference? Well, can it have more than one kind of reference? Or can that reference to that object be in more than one sense? I think it's a classic case of people starting to gnaw at each other's flesh before they think logically about the possibility that this may be a both-and kind of a thing. But at any rate, to say it another way, was the ground of God's choice essentially before the fall or with an eye toward the fall already given? So supra-lapse, meaning above and beyond the fall, infra-lapse, meaning with respect to or within or from out of the fall. I can see verses piling up on both sides, maybe because they're both true about something different. All right, so the theologian should immediately see this as a false dilemma. The two horns of the dilemma are really dealing with two different questions as to ultimacy and form. Superlapsed Arianism is asking the question, the same question, but they mean, in other words, the fallacy of equivocation is happening between the two sides. Superlapsed Arianism is saying, with reference to, in other words, ultimate ground reference, where infralapsed Arians are saying, with respect to form, what does he take them out of? Nothing in particular or something? The fall. I'm going to show you what the motive of that is in just a second. But when it comes to the ultimate grounds for God's choice, the scriptures are clear that it is in God from before the foundations of the world. Ephesians 1, 4 and 5. Verse 11. Revelation 13, 8. Revelation 17, 8. And I can list other places. So clearly those are supralapsarian verses. What is the cause of God's choice? Now the ball, the arrow of cause is in danger of becoming before God. Was that blob, the same lump of clay, falling before God? Of course not. That would be atheism. Supralapsarians are guarding against atheism. And rightly so. Okay? That's high octane, nothing comes before it kind of Calvinism. Which is why Calvin and Beza held it, rightly. Infralapsarians are saying something important too. When it comes to the relationship between the pity of God, His motive for choosing, as opposed to who He chooses for something else, when it comes to the relationship between that pity and the material of sinners, well then of course it's out of the same lump of clay that He chooses. That's the material, and you might even say formal cause, and you can look at Romans 9, from the same lump of clay. He makes some for honorable use and some for dishonorable use. So the infralapsarians are right about that. Now, infralapsarian, now when you make them into isms, you're ignoring the other sense of the question. Infralapsarianism is very alluring because it seems kinder and gentler to restrict predestination to the sphere within the fall, getting God off the hook for causing the fall at all, at any level. J.I. Packer, for example, in his lecture series at RTS Seminary on the theology of the history of the Puritans, points out that the Westminster Confession is an infralapsarianism document, and rightly so. It's a kinder Calvinism. And I would say, I love J.I. Packer, but again, he did not carefully consider the sense in which they're talking about two different questions. You don't have to pit one against the other. If your motive for putting the ism to it is a kinder, gentler form, again, it's not a big enough scope in your thinking at that point. All right. Well, that debate, again, was short-sighted from the beginning. And the English church, riddled with compromise from their beginning, made that debate infamous. The kind of thing that people can point to and say, you know, you Calvinists, just like the medieval people, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? This is your angels and pin right here. You see these big words, and you're like, what a bunch of lunatics. Well, it would have been solved if you... I'd say the English church, so much compromise from the beginning, probably didn't help in their debate over it. It would be better to say that Bullinger emphasized the rescuing sense of election, whereas Calvin and Beza emphasized the decreeing seat of election. I really doubt whether either original party would have denied the truth of the other if it had been put to them that way. At any rate, there was not a total consensus in either Geneva or Zurich, though one had to walk the line more fully down in Calvin's country as a result of an official statement on predestination called the Consensus Genevensis, the Genevensis, Genevensis. There you go. It was a consensus, anyway. I think it was only on predestination and the Lord's Supper, and so you couldn't make a whole creed out of it, so hang on to that idea. But, you know, up in Zurich, you had people like their main exegete was a guy named Theodore Bibliander. That's by the way, if you want to be a scholar of the Bible, just like the philosopher John Wisdom, may I suggest a name like Bibliander. If you don't already have a name, reach into the Latin or the Greek and give yourself that name. Anyway, he held to the position of Erasmus, which was really only a studied ambiguity that waited for the semi-Pelagian view to return to prestige. But I think this shows that Bullinger, for all that was profound in his broad vision, was not as discerning about the role of this doctrine as Calvin and Beza were. His basic policy was tolerance across the board. Now, as far as the Lord's Supper, he would depart from Zwingli only slightly toward Calvin's view on the Lord's Supper, focusing on its objectivity really ignoring the question, the notion of presence. What sense in which is the Lord present in these emblems? He compared the presence, though. He did say one thing on it. He had a metaphor. He compared the presence of God in the elements, or in the sacrament itself, to be a bit like the light and the heat of the sun, which is nevertheless still in the heavens. So the object is not here, but something of it. And it was just a metaphor, but I think it's a somewhat helpful one. If you're talking about the Holy Spirit in the faith of the believer, which I think he was. So, finally, because of this, because these were insufficient and local creeds, the Swiss and even Strasbourg, the Reformed world, capital R, was saying, we need a creed. We need something to unify us and not depend on the governments for that. Let's come up with our own creed. We'll present it to the governments, but we need to come up with our own profession of faith. And so enter the two Helvetic confessions. And the word Helvetic is just synonym for Swiss. Oy, oy, oy. Helvetic, okay? But, obviously, people from southern Germany and, of course, eastern France allied themselves with us. And you can see how much Geneva is becoming a center of hope for people in Europe, because there were a lot of refugees pouring in from Italy and France and other places, and Geneva was like this new Jerusalem. But at any rate, Zurich was participating at this point. The first Helvetic Confession was in 1536. It was signed in Basel, but unlike a previous creedal statement that was formed there, this one wasn't just local. All the Reformed would have a stake in it. And the Strasbourg residents, Bucer and Capito, obviously they had been friends of Calvin when he was there, they were instrumental in bringing it about so that it was not only for the Swiss, technically speaking. And though it could not bring total unity between Lutheran and Reformed groups, it was seen as a start. To everyone's delight, when Bucer had forwarded a copy to Luther, he was very much impressed with it. So again, 1536, Luther's still alive. There's 27 articles in all, and the section on the sacraments is actually more informed by Zwingli's view than by Luther's, and so that's why it's one of the reasons why it's so surprising that Luther was okay with this for the most part. First of all, he didn't have to care about it too much because the Lutherans up north were already under a confession, the Augsburg Confession of 1530. So he was just... That was one of Luther's charitable moments. And then, of course, just a couple years later, right before his death, he fights with Zwingli again. And so that wasn't helpful, and it prevented that true unity that could have happened. But anyway, Second Helvetic Confession, 1566, is more important down to our day. And it was this one that was penned by Bullinger. Now, originally, it was just meant as a kind of a last will and testament of faith from his deathbed. He was just penning that for personal reasons and for his church. Because there was another plague that was coming through in the 1560s. He wound up living for another 10 years or so. By the time, he thought he was going to die. And so he's penning this thing, and but then he recovers. And while he was recovering, Frederick III, so he's in the line of Frederick the Wise up in Germany, Frederick III was so impressed by it that he wanted to use it to answer those up north who wanted his head for siding too much with the Swiss. So Frederick had gotten into this hot water to begin with by promoting the publication of another reformed Swiss document called the Heidelberg Catechism, and that was published in 1563. So you have all these foundational documents for the reformed world, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Helvetic Confession. Frederick has these things up north, and he's catching a lot of heat for not being nationally Lutheran, but of course the secular heads didn't care about religion so much. Now, the Swiss were equally motivated to improve upon the original confession. Beza would add a few changes of his own. Bullinger accepted those. And it was published in Zurich in March of 1566 in Latin and in German, and after a few weeks in French. It was sanctioned as the official creed as far away as Hungary and Poland. And though it was superseded among the British, it was very highly esteemed there as well. So here you have the closest thing to a universal reformed creed. Now, of course, again, Augsburg Confession ruled this world and spread up north, as I said, and a little bit to the east. However, everywhere else, the Helvetic Confession... Now, when I put the circle that big, these are not reformed lands, but there's people, there's churches underground in places like France and northern Italy and stuff like that. But the point is that it was a more universalizing reformed confession. And it would really be, now of course, we'll get to the Anglicans. They had the 39 articles and eventually the Westminster Confession for the Puritans, but we'll get to that, so I'll leave that alone. One other wrinkle of history that's interesting, I find it interesting, same time, 1560s, during the season that the health of Calvin and Bullinger was declining, the English reformer Thomas Cranmer sent letters out to Bucer, Melanchthon, Calvin, and Bullinger, among others, to come to London to form an evangelical conference, to form an even more universal creed than the Helvetic Confession. And if this had come to fruition, maybe this is more what if. What if that had happened? Maybe the unity of the modern evangelical church would have gone in a different direction, and perhaps liberal theology and the apostasy of the European church might have been resisted as well. Now, if you talk about ecumenicalism, if these guys are running it, Calvin, Cranmer, Melanchthon, Bullinger, and they could curb Melanchthon's, more humanistic strand, I'd be pretty comfortable with an evangelical capital E church. Didn't happen. Calvin died. Calvin said, I'd come there and cross whatever he said, 1,000 seas to make that happen. But I think his health was already declining at that time. Anyway, Bullinger would survive until 1575, preaching his last sermon on the Sunday of Pentecost. Like Calvin, he would assemble the leaders of the city around his deathbed, giving parting instructions and preaching the gospel. He was buried at Grossmünster alongside his wife and also his fellow reformer, Peter Martyr. Beza, let me briefly go into Beza. His dates are 1519 to 1605. Beza was Calvin's successor in Geneva. In addition to being his first biographer, Beza wrote a biography of Calvin. And like his forerunner, he was from France, and like him, he attended Paris, Orleans, Bourges, the same schools for a higher education. And once Francis I had issued his edict against the Protestants in 1534, he returned to Orleans to study law, being not yet gripped by the evangelical doctrines. After graduating in 1539, he would spend the better part of the next decade practicing law and beginning a family in Paris. And here's what awakened him. Much like Zwingli, he had to become gravely ill. And that happened in 1548, which really alerted him to his mortality, and he started to look into the gospel more. Well, he immediately fled to Geneva, realizing that refuge there was the only place for somebody who now believed the gospel. And after being welcomed by Calvin, he would seek a professorship in Lausanne? How do you pronounce that? Lausanne. Too close to Lasagna, so I didn't go with it. I'm going to go with that. Okay. He would study Greek there, and yet he would spend his time away from Geneva writing a series of works that really, they didn't retain their fame, but at the time they were widely accepted. There was a poem, a satire, and criticizing Rome, and a defense of Calvin's role in the fate of Servetus. He would undertake two journeys to Worms up north with Farel in order to enlist the help of the German magistrates to stop the persecution of French Protestants. In a sense, they were saying, you know, you guys are at war with France anyway. For the love of Pete, if you're really Protestants, can you go in there and help the Huguenots? And they were refused every time. Finally, in 1558, Beza came to his calling in Geneva, where he would teach Greek at the academy. And when Calvin had died, he also took over the chair of theology as well. One of the ironies of history, as we see the baton passed on from Calvin to Beza, is that if you asked the average Protestant anywhere in Europe in the latter half of the 16th century, Geneva was kind of like, what did Reagan say about America? Man's last best hope on earth. That was the way Calvin and Geneva were looked at as, interestingly, like the symbol on the Red Cross. Which of course was a white cross, but they were looked at as the hospitality zone. What am I looking for? That of the center of charity and generosity and humility and hope, and in other words, everything you usually think the opposite of when you think of these guys. If you ask anybody there, they had the highest respect, not only for the city they had created, but for the persons there that were leading the city. For three straight years, from 1560 to 1562, Beza would meet with the French king and then other representatives of the church in order to allow for toleration to the Protestants. From the start, Beza would overthrow them in argument after argument, really only accomplished indignation to rise from the French. And so that finally, even after an edict granting some rights was passed, the Catholic authorities had orchestrated what became known as the Massacre of Vassy on March 1st, 1561. He befriended the Huguenot leader Condé, I think is how you pronounce this name, and he circulated a letter to his men, to his army, to ready themselves for battle. And he then went on to several places in Europe for support, but found little. And so the military leader accepted an edict of pacification on March 12th of the following year. And it was during that same time, really the Huguenots would lose momentum at that time, and there was another massacre later on. It was called the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in 1572. So Beza's heart would really always be with the French church. He's working out creeds with them, pastoral issues with them, and so on. But they really lost a lot of that momentum and were exterminated, killed out, fleed, and things like that. But Calvin's health started to decline at this time. And so Calvin died. Beza took over. A couple of theological wrinkles still had to be ironed out in the 1570s. In the first place, he would have to restate the Calvinistic teaching on the Lord's Supper. Secondly, he wrote something on politics, on the rights of magistrates to argue for restricted power. By the way, at this time, next 50 years, there must have been 100 theological treatises written on politics coming out of Geneva. So, huge influence everywhere, and this formed the library of the Founding Fathers. A lot of things that you just don't hear about anymore. Beza had a couple more controversies I'm not going to get into too much, and obviously I'm not going to have any time to get into these distinctions between spiritualism and rationalism. It's just as well, because I was going to talk about next week, I was even debating whether or not to get into the English Reformation. Oh, I'm going to get to that. The English Reformation or the Counter-Reformation. And so maybe this is a good place, these temptations, which I'll wait for that, because that'll start to get into resistance and ways that the Reformation was slowed down, stopped, or had to transfer. So in closing, let me look at this chart. I have here this thing called the Power of Purity Principle. And I have here, first of all, up north, Wittenberg, 1520-ish, and those waves of influence coming out from them. You'll see as it expands up north and to the east, and other places, a thinning out. That represents a thinning out. So Melanchthon's compromises, and eventually you get to the 17th century, Lutheranism starts to become what we know as pietism and becomes liberal. Well, over here, these things represent, this wall represents a check, a secular stop to the Lutheran cause. And eventually, as I said, Charles V took over Frederick's domain and Saxony and so on. And so Lutheranism is basically told change or die, in a sense. It was already compromised through Melanchthon, but now it, with the exception of Strasbourg and those guys down there who were aligning with the Swiss, it was pretty much, it becomes the thing that you know it today, pretty quickly. Not to say there wasn't genuine faith through the centuries, not to say there weren't real Christians, not to say there's not, you know, we know the conservative, like the Missouri Synod today in America. Good Lutheran churches, good Lutheran pastors, don't take that the wrong way. What I'm saying is that Lutheranism, as the kind of thing that would free the slaves, tear down the Berlin Wall, expand the church in its purity, Lutheranism wasn't going to be that thing. Why? Because it was compromised. Okay, move on to Zurich down here. So I have 1530-ish, and you have that influence. Bullinger takes over for Zwingli. The systematic expression is not there from the beginning the way it is in Calvin. 1531, as they overreach and try to overthrow the Roman cantons, the armies that are funded by the Pope, they were not expecting it, and in 1531, that wall that pretty much lasts into the modern world divides up Switzerland that way, and it remained that way to this day. Okay? So they're stopped because they compromised. What happened in Geneva? What are you saying? There's no compromise in Geneva? Not saying that at all. But to the degree that they got the Bible more right, the world was absolutely changed. Why does the world look the way it is right now? Combination of good things and bad things. Where did all the good things come from? Geneva, period. And that's a fact that even secularists recognize. There's a reason for it. What's the lesson? Do it again. That's the lesson. And if that's not the lesson, what the heck are we living for? Can we be good Christians without that? Not if you talk like that. What? Are you the kind of person that reads 1 Corinthians 3 and say, oh good, there's a guy that escapes with his pants on fire in heaven. He doesn't build the house of gold and it lasts, it's straw and it's burned up, but at least he gets to heaven with his underwear on fire. Really? Is that what you hear when Paul's saying, good, there's a lowest common denominator I can just get through. Well, then nothing else I say in church history will be of any help to you. So, there you go. Next week, English Reformation.